Hello and welcome to the latest edition of Bowler's Desk Political Podcast. This time, Rick Epps and I met up down at, let's see if I can pronounce this correctly, Rogo Park. It's a new park down between the USS Midway Museum and Seaport Village. It's nice, you know, it's a very nice little park. It's got this, you know, modernist, minimalist style. It was, you know, done in honor of a local San Diego architect, Lloyd Rogo, who, you know, brought modernism and minimalism architecture to San Diego, or at least he's credited with bringing that style here. You know, my only criticism of the park, and this is a criticism I have for lots of parks in San Diego, there's no shade. They've got these great-looking minimalist, modernist-style benches for people to sit on. They look very contemporary, but they're not in the shade. So who's going to sit out in the sun for more than 5 minutes? Maybe that was their plan. Maybe they don't want people sitting there for a long time, but there's no shade there. Trees aren't going to grow into shade because of the way the city trims trees. They don't grow big enough to produce amount of shade that will go over any of the park benches or any of the picnic benches. I mean, this is a big problem. When they remodeled San Diego State, they remodeled it and they took out all the trees and grass and put in all this brick. And so now San Diego State's this big oven. I don't know. That's kind of my soapbox as far as parks go. You know, more shade is better. This is a desert on the beach. This is not a tropical environment. San Diego's a chaparral desert that meets the beach. We need shade. You know, you go 10 miles inland and it gets 100 degrees in the summertime. You need to build parks and public spaces with shade. You know, I've often thought that they were hiring out-of-town architects, people from the East Coast or the Northeast who don't get any sunshine, and think, oh, great, you're in San Diego. Let's everybody bake in the sun. That's what you want to do out there. And that's just stupid because it's not what people want. They want to sit someplace in the shade. The sun is nice, but it's not nice to sit in for any long period of time because you're going to fry after 15 minutes. All right. Okay, I promise I'm done. Anyhow, so we sat there and we talked about all kinds of stuff. We started with local politics. Filner faced his third mayoral veto override in a row. You know, we talked about why local politics is important and why it matters to people and how, you know, we think people should be involved. You can at least be interested in it. And that's something that, you know, I'm always pushing people to be, is at least interested in what's going on locally for them. Also, we talked about the TMD and my thoughts on a new ad campaign, and I'll put a picture up of what I think could be a great new way of having the whole ad campaign for San Diego. We don't need to hire anybody. We can do the whole thing with cell phone pictures. San Diego's just that kind of place. You don't need to up-produce San Diego. I don't know. It just seems like a waste of money to me to hire crews to sell San Diego when you don't need to sell this city. I bet you could do the whole thing with social media. Anyhow, and we also talked about Syria, of course. The red line has been crossed. You know, the West is going to start funneling weapons to the opposition. Russia is funneling weapons to the Assad regime. What does that mean? Turkey, the uprising there. It started with a couple of hippies in a park, and it's turned into this whole big political thing that's touching the president of Turkey in the elections there. And what does that mean for them? We also talked about the G8 in Belfast, the G8 summit, what that means to you and me. And as always, if you want to hop on your soapbox, call us, leave us a message, and we may put it in the political podcast. 619-663-4531. 619-663-4531. All right. San Diego's political podcast. Matt Bowler, Rick Epps, bowlersdesk.com.
San Diego was a big fishing, you know, big fishing area, and this is where everybody came. This is where it all happened. So, you know, a lot of my friends, families made money from here. You know,
oh, definitely. So there you go.
Yep, yep.
This is where we are. Another political podcast. Come on down, check it out. We like coming outside and
hanging out and talking, because it's San Diego. Why wouldn't you go outside?
A beautiful Sunday too. It's gorgeous out here.
Down here.
Don't hate us, okay? We're just.
I can see the Midway and then the Eisenstadt statue that they were going to tear down and then replaced. The kissing sailor. Eisenstadt's the photographer who took that.
Yeah.
That day,
and
all anybody does is go underneath and look up her dress.
No, really, exactly.
That's all anybody does. But but there it is. It's iconish, I guess. You know.
Yeah, you
and
know.
Then the you know, and the statue. It's like this nostalgia thing. They've also got that Bob Hope Memorial over there too.
Exactly. Well, I think that's a great thing. I mean, I think it's actually a really cool thing. My dad actually got to, and when he was with Security Pacific National Bank, got to meet Bob Hope when he was he was a VP at Security Pacific National Bank here.
Oh, and, that's cool.
They got the, and they helped contribute to the Bob Hope Golf Classic, so he got to go. Cool. Of course, my dad's golf score is like a bowling score. No offense, Dad.
I wouldn't even know what that is. I've only played miniature golf.
That's about the same with me too. I'd be like Kevin Costner in Tin Cup.
Yeah,
that would
be
me.
Pretty bad. Would be bad.
Happy Father's Day to all the fathers out there. Let me say that real quick.
Yeah, we're recording Father's Day.
Yep.
I don't know if I'll get this up in time for that. If tonight or maybe tomorrow.
Yeah, you know, but you know, guys, we're always late anyway, so it's okay. We won't hear it till tomorrow anyway. Yeah. It's good.
So before we get into all the international stuff, locally, I think it's interesting this week, the third veto override, Filner. You know, so he keeps putting these vetoes out there, the strong mayor thing, and that's the thing about the strong mayor thing. Yeah. So you can still be overridden. Yeah. It's the Democratic majority city council, and he still can't maintain his vetoes.
Yeah.
It makes you wonder a lot whether or not he's ineffectual or effectual, or what his real problem is, or how has the Democratic Party within San Diego changed. I remember talking to Todd Glory about this just after they redrew the district lines.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, Todd Glory's district went from being City Heights, Normal Heights, and parts of Hillcrest to being Hillcrest, Golden Hill, and downtown.
Like, wow. Okay.
And how
that
he
changed,
was.
Demographic change.
Demographic totally changes that way.
Yeah.
You know, there's so much more money and so much more political involvement downtown.
Absolutely.
And they're conservative.
Yeah.
Because it's money. Yeah. Most of the people politically involved. In other communities here, you have those neighborhood communities, you know, the neighborhood boards, and they advise the city council people on what they want to do. And city council people have told me, they've said, yeah, most of the time it's just whoever happens to show up, because most people just don't even know these things exist.
Yeah.
So it's one or two retirees
that
essentially become the community advisory board to whatever city council person, except for downtown. In downtown, it is a highly competitive process, and it's all run by, and they're all lawyers on this board, and they're all very serious about it.
Yeah.
So it's I think that has really affected Todd Glory's politics.
Yeah.
And that is the kind of thing that I think is changing the kind of the tone in the city council, especially with regard to their relationship to Bob Filner.
Well, I think it's also also confronting the reality of politics, right? I think the old days, remember Bob Filner sold himself, and even when we did the thing at Fox, you know, then he's the poor, he's a 1970s Democrat, and that's sort of been his stance, which is nothing wrong with. I'm not saying there's a slap at the 1970s Democrats at all. There's nothing wrong with that at all. The problem is just that I think a lot of them, instead of following what they know to be right in their own personal ethical views, are now following whatever trend that helps them stay elected. And so, consequently, it's not about, you know, whether Todd actually, you know, is following his own path because he's shifting his ideas, or whether it's simply a matter of the fact that he is catering to those who are going to help him financially, help his political career financially.
Yeah.
And that's usually where they start.
Todd wants to be in Congress.
Exactly. So he's going to drink.
He has bigger dreams.
Yeah, he's going to drink the Kool-Aid to do that. So.
I think he's only got one more term left, too.
Yeah.
And then he's done. Right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So if that's the case, then. But again, this is the stress. This is why we, the people, have to be more cognizant of these issues, which most people aren't. Most people don't even know about local politics. I mean, they barely know national politics. The local stuff is even more complicated.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's essential, because what they don't realize is that when these things are being decided upon, they're not a part of the political process. And then, again, you get to the issue of what's democracy at that point, because it's not democracy if you're not participating in it.
Yeah, it always kills me, too, because it's like the same people that say they're informed are the same people that really don't watch local news. Or when they do watch local news, it's they kind of blow it off in a lot of ways. And so local news then, in turn, decides that they need to gain these viewers back, and so they pander to these audiences and diminish the quality of the work coming out. But it's, you can't throw the whole onus onto the station, the whole responsibility, because
no, of course not.
They have to pay bills.
Oh, absolutely.
You know what I mean? Yeah. They have to sell ad space, and if these guys aren't watching their shows, yeah. You know, and then it always kills me. I talk to these friends of mine who, you know, I think are smart and I respect, and all they do is bitch about local news, but then in their next breath, they're like, well, I only watch the BBC. What's no. Who the fuck cares if you only watch the BBC? Because it doesn't tell you anything about what's going on here.
No,
now.
It doesn't. It
tells you something maybe that's sort of going on abroad from their particular lens that has gone through their board of censors, and that's a government-run media organization.
Exactly.
And the hypocrisy there, even within the kind of the groups of people that consider themselves informed, has always driven me up the friggin' wall.
Well, especially because when you look at it, you know, you're talking about people who essentially, I mean, the news, let's face it, the media today gives you what you want and what's been what we call a term called genuflection, right? Where we reflect back to you what we want you to think is important. And so therefore you've been sold an idea.
Yeah, we're validating your reality.
Exactly. So so if you want to live the alternate reality, then what we'll do is we'll give you the alternate reality and keep you comfortably numb and looking and dealing with the things that the stylistic stuff that keeps you more as a less of a citizen, right?
Mm-hmm.
And much more of a consumer. And that's what they know. It's what you like, and so they, instead of you even realizing that you need something more to be informed, you know, you don't even know what you need because nobody's showing it to you because you're not actively involved in your own
and
local
then
government.
And then you've got these people, and people see local government as some sort of pejorative. Yep. When I think it's the first, it is the front line of politics.
Absolutely.
And you know, you look at organizations like the Lincoln Club that have been able to obtain a lot of power, and you got to give these guys credit because they're organized, they're smart, they know what they want, and they stand their ground in a lot of ways, and they're involved, they're part of that world, and then, you know, but that's like it, right?
There's
these few, or there's these extremist kind of left wing groups or extremist kind of right wing groups, but there's not a lot in the middle. It just doesn't seem like there's a lot of accessibility from regular folks and at the same time a lot of interest. And so you end up with these conflicts that are going on. So you've got, you know, Filner and in his fight with the TMD. Now, if Filner wasn't as abrasive a person, I think that this fight would be easier for him to win.
Yeah.
It's just his personality is so difficult to sell things. Whereas, like, I think that if somebody like Fletcher was taking Filner's position because his personality is so much more pleasant, that he probably would be able to win this fight or at least have a lot more of an effect.
Yeah, I mean, but I agree. I think Nathan would be, you know, certainly more political and be more politically correct in how he tried to, you know, create a partisan consensus. You know, he would try and go down that road, and he would give and take a little bit. And I think, I'll give Bob credit to us with the notion of, I think he really, truly in his heart believes he's doing the right thing. I think maybe his understanding of the battle tactic, and I think he sort of maybe thought that the Democrats in the city council would basically back anything that he wanted to push. Mm-hmm. And I think now that he's having to confront that reality, he's a smart guy. I'm sure he's confronting the reality of recognizing the demographic shifts and how he's going to have to deal with playing with those who want to have a long-term political future after this.
You know, though, the thing is, though, is that he's a true believer.
Yeah.
I honestly believe he is doing what he thinks is right.
Absolutely.
And so I totally respect him for that. Whereas Nathan has a lot more of a problem there because he can't. He comes off as wishy-washy, switched parties.
Yeah.
He didn't. He switched parties for the money. So it's obvious. So a lot of people are going to say, "Well, you're for sale."
Yeah.
You're not doing this because you're a true believer or as much of a true believer. You know, he became a Democrat because he wants to have a political future, and you can't have a political future unless you have a party affiliation.
Yeah.
And he left the Republican Party because of that. Now, at the same time, you could say people grow, people change, and
but here's the interesting thing with this. Let me share this with you. I think it's interesting about this. I think there's a part of the Republican Party that shifted back toward the middle, away from the fringe elements of the Republican Party.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so the ideological aspect of that, in terms of looking at where the Democrats are today, which are a much more moderate party than people really give them credit for, because there is the Democrats today are not what people try and sell them off to be publicly. They're not this socialist left movement. It's not the Democratic Party of 2013 at all. So the shift, I would argue, if Nathan wanted to put a good argument up, he would simply say, you know what, the moderate Republicans and the Democrats are much more closely associated than people have ever given them credit for. Therefore, the shift wasn't a major shift. It was just maybe, you know, be honest. Hey, I care about some of the social issues that normally aren't relevant, you know, to those who sit on the right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't think it's going to be that far of a push for him. And a couple of years from now, who's going to remember that shift anyway?
Oh, whoever is running against him.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly.
This is not going to be forgotten.
Yeah, but the average citizen is, the average citizen, unless the Democrats find somebody
right, because they're
charismatic.
Not interested. Yeah, you know, and they're not running. Interested in local politics. So
exactly.
They're just going to hear some sort of soundbite and kind of regurgitate that.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. Which is really sad.
Yeah, and he's got the look. I mean, he's got charisma. He's got the look. I mean,
I look at the TMD, and I remember. I don't remember when this was created, but before the TMD, I mean, they're essentially a group of hotel owners.
Yeah,
and they're selling their hotels in other cities.
Exactly.
And now, honestly, I have to question why San Diego needs an ad campaign. We don't need an ad campaign.
No,
everyone knows we exist.
Yeah.
Number one. If TMD stopped running ads tomorrow, there would be no impact on our tourism. I don't believe that.
No.
I don't believe it would impact us in the slightest.
No.
Now, it may impact whether or not people go to the Hilton versus the Marriott,
yeah.
which is really what the TMD spending is about.
Yeah.
It's about getting people into specific hotels, not getting people into the town
exactly.
in general.
Yeah, people come here.
People know San Diego exists. And you know, we don't need to hire a crew. I guarantee you we could run an entire... I bet you could run an entire... You don't need to hire crews to go film commercials and then buy airtime. I bet you could do a San Diego just on free social media with fucking cell phone pictures.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean,
take a shot right here. We could put it up and be ready.
Yeah,
let's go here.
Yeah, there you go. Visit San Diego. You don't need those ads.
No, what we need is business. We need some high-rise
companies. And that's
businesses.
The other thing is that the TMD, the tourism is the worst thing you can do for an economy.
Yep.
And I look at countries like Jamaica. And they're totally reliant on tourism.
Yep.
And their economy is in the crapper.
Yeah.
And I look at places like Tijuana had such a huge part of their economy reliant on tourism. And that is a dead industry there now because of the border waits, because of
corruption
and of all of these other Americans and stuff. Basically, I don't think any of that had... I think it's because they started asking for passports and teenagers don't have access to passports.
Yeah.
And Tijuana's
a problem.
Entirely economy was... tourism economy.
But Mexico, let's face it, Mexico's that way. That's the problem with Mexico. Mexico basically is relying on tourists as an industry.
It's horrible.
And now when the tourism goes down, I mean, the Mexican economy is in defunct if there's no tourism.
It's the worst thing you can do for an economy in a region. I mean, I think it's great. It's nice that we have these nice places and all that, but they should be for the locals first, and tourists just happen to come here.
Yeah.
You know what? That makes for better tourism.
Absolutely.
Also, it's because you're getting a taste of a region and getting a sense of an area, not this contrived... down, like, you know, I mean, the gas lamp is fun, but let's face it, that's an adult theme park
exactly.
for tourists. That is not for locals.
No, it's not. And the funny thing about it, I look at our downtown landscape when we're sitting here looking to the east, and I always say, you know, that you can tell the true value of a city when you look at the downtown. And I say 50 to 70% of our high rises are all hotels or residences and are not business interests. So
yeah, and most of the residences are empty.
And like, most of the residences are empty.
Nobody can afford to live in them.
Exactly. So they're all dressed up and nowhere to go.
So I, you know, you got to give Filner credit because there's millions of dollars there, and why would he not give that money to the police force?
Yeah.
Now, the way he went about it is probably the wrong way.
Exactly.
He could have. He's just not a smooth guy, and I think they handled that whole process and that whole campaign was not handled as well as it could. And I'm sure there's all kinds of internal political things that happened within his administration too that caused it to be that way. And I don't know what kind of micromanager he is, what kind of micromanager he isn't. You know, who's running what? So, but his argument has merit.
Yeah.
And I think just summarily dismissing it because you don't like the way he looks on TV is fucking retarded.
Yeah, just because he's irascible, there's no reason to say that the politics
and
or what his agenda is.
He's not pretty.
Yeah.
He's not a pretty man.
Yeah.
I don't look at Bob Filner and think, no, there's a pretty man. You know, no one would put Bob Filner on the cover of GQ. It just wouldn't happen.
Sorry, Bob.
Sorry. But, yeah, I know, they listen. They listen, too. I think Tony Kravark, the chairman of the San Diego Republican Party, would probably agree with you that the Republicans are shifting definitely more towards moderates now than they were in the past, and they're trying to really kind of get rid of this fanatical right wing.
Well, they're trying to reimage themselves.
Because they lost people.
Well, they're trying to reimage themselves, and the only concern I have about that, and it's and I think it's also people within politics across the board would recognize the same concern, and that is, you know, it's one thing to say that you're changing because you want to get the votes. It's another thing entirely to have a paradigm shift where the psychology of your own internal ethos is now recognizes that you need to deal with the immigration issue, that you need to deal with you know all the various issues that have been sort of on the opposite end
you're basically saying they're being insincere.
Well, I'm saying I'm concerned about those who are just pandering for votes versus those who sincerely recognize that the agenda that had been so proffered in the last decade by the right is really leaving their consciousness. In other words, it's one thing for me to say, well, I really am really realizing I have a crisis of consciousness and go, I really need to take a different look at how I see immigration, let's say, or immigration issue.
Yeah.
And, you know, but am I doing that because I just want votes? Am I doing that because I really believe, internally that this is the right thing to do?
Yeah.
And that's the thing I think that people are going to have to really be careful and look at with regard to this issue. I hope they are making a change and that there is a new paradigm that's going to reflect the new Republican Party or the new changes in the Republican Party. If they want to have a future in this country, I think they're going to have to. I think if they want to survive.
I think there's way too much money involved for them not to make not to make a shift. They're not going to just disappear.
Well, that's what the Democrats did. Let's face it. The Democrats, the Filner Democrats, now you know, become very centrist because they realized they were never going to, whether you arguably could agree they were on the far right or not, or far left or not, it's not the issue. The fact is, the image they had was being way too far to the left, and now they're much more moderate. And from the Clinton types all the way to the Obama types, these are not your old left-wing Democrats. These are very moderate. If some arguably you could say they're just left-wing Republicans.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's what I call it's called them, really. Yeah, yeah. I mean, and idealistically, it's what they are. So no offense to that either, by the way. It isn't just a word, but just the fact that that's where their politics happen to land them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so let's go into the more interesting stuff. The more interesting stuff, the NSA.
Ooh.
And everybody talking about the Snowden leaks here. You know, and I've been trying to pull up the press briefing from the White House. I'll see if I can get this thing to roll up to the point where I want it to. When it gets there, I'll start playing it. The information that he says the NSA had access to, I'm from the from Verizon. Was it? It was Verizon cell phone carriers, things like that.
Yeah.
I really wonder. Is that information that let's say like Ralph's could just decide to go buy from Verizon, and had the government just bought the information, would there be a problem here?
That's an interesting question.
I mean, isn't it essentially just like marketing? They weren't looking at individuals; they were looking at trends, and then using those trends to find individuals. I think is how I understand it, right?
Yeah, it's no different than when the internet, when you go on websites, and then they automatically you start getting a barrage of emails, you know, from all the extra sites that are tethered to those sites, you know.
Because that information is already out there.
Yeah, I think it's a marketing.
And that's what Facebook exists for. That's the only way they make any money is they take all of your information, they network it with all of your other people's information, they take what you're talking about and use that as part of... Now, it's just that the government has access to it.
Yeah.
And that's what people are...
That's what people don't like.
But
let's face it, it's not new business. It's actually old business, you know? And I think people don't recognize that this is a business.
I remember watching a Frontline about 5 years ago, and I think they just re-aired three-part series that they did on the NSA, and one of them was basically that they're listening and that they had all these satellite arrays and they're grabbing all of these communications that are happening, and then they're running them through their supercomputers. I suppose the difference is that the company gave it to the government specifically for this goal, made it easier for them to do this kind of thing. But at the same time, it wasn't like they gave it directly to the government. They gave it to a contractor.
Exactly.
And it was this contractor then that took that information, interpreted it, and then passed that along. Well, and I think that dynamic is something that needs to be addressed too, because nobody wants to hire these people. You want to have government, you want to cut government, but you still want these programs.
Well, the thing about it, I think the interesting thing still happens to be, well, why not AT&T? Why not the other carriers? Why not Sprint?
Well, there was a big release recently about Facebook, and I want to say a few other cell phone carriers came out, and they basically said that they've had thousands. Facebook had said they had something like 8,000 requests that they filled from various governments, from local sheriffs, looking to find suspects or looking for information on suspects to big federal government kind of investigations.
Yeah.
So it's not like these aren't commonplace to begin with.
Yeah.
But the thing that surprises me is that, okay, the government is not this separate entity. We live in a republic. The government is us.
Yeah.
First place. So,
for those who don't know that, that's...
the government is us.
Yeah, we are the government.
We are the government. That's the thing. I mean, America's a pirate ship.
Yeah,
okay?
Exactly.
And people are elected to be in charge. And it is us. It's not this separate entity that is imposed upon us. It is us. And that this information is already available. Now, why is it okay for, let's say, Ralph's to buy this kind of information and use it to sell me watermelons, yeah, but it's not okay for the government to use this to stop terrorism?
Well, I think that's the question of the day. I mean, I think people have this notion that there's this huge nefarious organization called the government that's going to completely abuse them. And, you know, let's face it, rightly, I think in some ways it's a fair assessment. It's a fair concern. Mm-hmm. Can the government use it for damaging information? Absolutely. Can they use it for the right and go in and look for terrorists? Absolutely. Is the risk worth the information being out there? Arguably,
But what were they gathering this information in this way? Have they done that in the past? That's my question. You know what I mean? Or is this sort of the first time in our point history where this kind of information in this magnitude is available?
Well, it's been available for at least the last, you know, decade and a half, you know, with the technology that we've had. So, I mean, it's...
Is this going to turn into the IRS scandal where now it turns out all those people were Bush appointees? Is it going to turn into one of those things?
Well, it could, but I doubt it. I think it's more the issue, and this is where the government gets itself in trouble, right? Because for the sake of security, and I recognize the need for confidentiality and classified information, they can't divulge why they do certain things. But then when it comes public like this, everybody goes, oh my God, look what, you know, how could they? And yet, that's what I said, half the country believes it's an okay thing. You know, more than half believe it's okay. It's just the fact that they didn't know ahead of time. And, you know, some things you can't put to a vote. I mean, I've worked
now,
in
there wasn't
field,
there wasn't
know.
A court process for this
no, there
kind
was
of
not.
Thing. And that's the other thing that I think people are really concerned about is they feel like there's no recourse, that somebody ends up, somebody from some nebulous random contractor ends up in a position to where they can have access to this information.
Yeah.
And there's no subpoena process. There's no FISA process. None of that.
Well, I think what this actually points out, though, is that there should be some form of process, even if it's one that we're not privy to because of the confidentiality issues. There should be some sort of oversight that protects the consumers, the citizens, rather.
See?
Yeah, I know. I say
yeah,
consumers,
I mean,
because most people...
Is this why are we more comfortable with this kind of plutocratic arrangement?
Yeah.
I mean, really, that's ultimately what I'm talking about. Why are we more comfortable with this as a plutocratic arrangement, as opposed to this as a arrangement within kind of a structure of a republic?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's
the struggle.
That seems to be the issue here, ultimately.
Yeah, yeah. I agree. I think out of this, you're going to see some new policies that will be developed. They'll have to confront the ins and outs of this. I think if they can create an oversight organization to be able to monitor and protect the citizens, then this goes away. Yeah. It goes away at some point. It's just a matter of, you know, they need the new, they have to have something new to sell. This is the new selling point on the hot topic of the block, you know?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's legitimate. Well, why is the government listening in on everyone's phone calls? I mean, because you can, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
but it's been going on for, I mean, it just happened a decade with after 9/11, the same thing happened with the Homeland Security. So what's the difference now? I mean, did we just forget about it for 10 years so nobody talked about it, and then all of a sudden now it's a blip on the screen on the radar again?
Makes you wonder.
Yeah.
You know, at the White House press briefing, let's see if this came up. It looks like it's going to actually play here. They brought out their NSA guy to talk about all of the national security things. And, of course, he saved Snowden for last, and at first he talked about Turkey and Syria and Iraq and Afghanistan to make sure that we understood the sort of the landscape,
or to make sure we had been so worn out,
bored by the time he got to what everybody wanted to hear about. Let's see if this thing plays here.
Schedule and giving a bit of a preview of what we hope to accomplish at these different stops. We will be arriving in Northern Ireland.
Oh, he's talking about the trip.
on the Monday morning.
Yeah.
Going to the G8 summit in Belfast, which it just blows my mind that we're having a G8 summit in Belfast.
I mean, who would have thought, right?
Who would have thought 10 years ago that you could do this? I have a blogger friend of mine who blogs for one of the prominent Belfast Northern Ireland blogs, Slugger O'Toole. So it's actually a really, really fascinating blog. He guy's a very kind of esoteric thinker when it comes to bigger political issues. And I think he's as amazed as I am that they're doing this. You know, he was in his 20s in the 70s and 80s when the Troubles were really, really a major problem.
Even when you and I were babies?
It just blows my mind that you can have this kind of thing in Northern Ireland now.
Yeah, truly, truly. Yeah,
but at the same time, you know, even at the height of the Troubles, there were less murders or less killings in Northern Ireland and the UK combined. Northern Ireland and the UK combined than I think there were in Detroit. You know, for 1 year versus the Troubles for the entirety of that 20-year period. So, I mean, having kind of the... It's always interesting when you give Americans a little bit of perspective on violence in the United States versus violence in war zones, how that's the reality of that situation. Go, wait a minute. Detroit's pretty fucking violent. You know?
That will pretty scary, huh?
In Syria.
Yeah.
That will include Afghanistan, where Russia has cooperated with us in securing both our transit routes for our troops and also promoting stability in the region. It will include nuclear weapons, arms control,
all the missile
defense,
talk about
and
here.
The security exactly. issues that we very regularly discuss with Russia. We'll also discuss issues related to counterterrorism cooperation, as well as deepening our economic and commercial ties between our two nations. Following that bilateral meeting, and there'll be a chance for the leaders to make statements at the conclusion of that meeting, there'll be a leader.
So how much of an emphasis do you think Syria is going to be?
This is the dinner that focuses on foreign policy at the G8. The other sessions, Caroline,
other than the context of the EU sends them weapons,
I think it ends up being...
Well, we're going to start sending them weapons now, too, right?
Isn't it funny how things change so quickly?
All of a sudden, it is a full-blown proxy war.
Well, yeah. I mean, a minute ago, everybody was like, well, looks like Assad's going to, you know, stay in power. And then everybody went, oh, wait a minute. Maybe that's not such a good idea after all. We better do something about this, especially with Russia, you know, supplying weapons, you know. So it's become a much more problematic thing.
Chemical weapons assessment.
Plus, I think it also has to deal with the FSA, the Free Syrian Army. Yeah. The there was some concern about factions within the army being, you know, Al-Qaeda, other Islamic militant organizations. So maybe internally they've got some information that now refutes some of that, so that looking at who would be the heir apparent maybe it becomes a possible change.
Yeah, who would take over? I mean, and are you going to get someone that's sort of West-friendly? You
well,
know, or
the
you
West
have
is getting involved.
Like
you know
Assad,
they
who's definitely Iran, more Russia-China friendly.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I think if you look at this, it looks like if Europe and the United States are getting more actively involved, then they must have a plan or somebody in place or an idea of who could step into this position and be more West-centric.
Yeah, well, you would hope, right?
Yeah.
But
well,
that's happened before.
If not, use the NSA to figure out who it is, you guys.
They've already got the phone calls.
That includes the United Kingdom, France, Germany.
You know, it's just amazing. So it's almost like the G8 now is being used as a tool to rally the kind of the European, the Western world.
It's like its own United Nations, yeah, like a subunit of the United Nations. You know?
It is. You know, a lot of people don't understand what the G8 is. Explain what the G8 is.
Well, the G8 basically, for the keep it simple version, is these are the eight most powerful countries on the planet, basically. That basically set the economic and political agendas for globally for all of us. Mm-hmm. That's the simplified version of it. They are the economic most powerful.
So what kind of people go to the G8? You get politicians. You do, but you get a lot of businessmen.
Yep. So it's heads of multinational corporations, plutocrats. These are all highest level, highest economic people on the planet. Really, these are who control and are part of the discourse within the G8. And sometimes the G8 is also the G20, the G. It's funny how that number changes all the time.
Yeah,
I think it depends on who gets to be part of the boys' club, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's funny how they change the number periodically.
Well, I mean, they say the G8, and then they list off like 15 countries, which I don't understand how that works either.
Yeah, I think it depends on where you are in the pecking order. It depends on what the issue is, too.
And then what kind of policies do they set there?
Well, usually it has to do with economic, global economic policies. You know, we're talking about global capitalism. I mean, that's what we're really talking about. We're also dealing with, you know, issues of globalization. Anything dealing with the issue of globalization, you know, goes to the G8 because the whole purpose of the G8 and a very sort of idealistic level, you know, I mean, you're talking about WTO kind of stuff. You're talking about, you know, the NAFTA stuff. You know, I mean, you're talking about organizations that try to keep the wheels of the global economy moving. You know, they deal with the issue of the poor, too. I mean, they look at the issue of, you know, the disenfranchised political south, meaning the southern hemisphere, normally considered the poor on the planet.
How did that even work out? So basically, the southern hemisphere of the planet is almost where all of the poor are.
Yeah, right? Yet it's where all the natural resources are too. They all reside in the south. So the north wants to exploit the south for the resources, but the intellectual and technological advanced countries are in the north for the most part. And I guess you have, you know, Australia, you have some countries that are obviously in the south, but they just use that as sort of a demarcation line to say that this is where the disadvantaged people are versus the advantaged people.
Cold War when Germany, West Berlin was under a considerable siege. It's also, again, notable in one respect in that it is the eastern side of the gate that the president will be speaking on, something that would have been impossible 50 years ago. But given the progress that's been made in Germany, given the fall of the Berlin
Wall, it does seem like
Obama's
trying to give himself, he's working a lot more on his legacy and a lot more on global issues as opposed to domestic. Is he stepping away from these kind of domestic things?
I think he is a little bit. I think it is, because let's face it, the president's a long-term legacy. I think he's realizing that his legacy within the country is pretty much, I wouldn't say it's undermined, but it's more of a stalemate. He's had some strides. He has a few successes. He's had some failures. I think now the issue for him is going to be, and the biggest step that I think would be rightly so for him would be to try and attack some of the global issues that could really have a lasting legacy for the United States and also for our allies in the West. And I think that's it's a positive thing. He's respected pretty well globally, so to be in a position where he can help change foreign policy and modify our stance and our prestige around the world, which I think he's actually done. I think if you look at where the United States was viewed,
well, isn't it? Do you think that's more because? Do you think that's more because people sort of outside the United States or outside of like European perspective, or is this like a definitely more of a global?
I think it's more global, to be honest with you. I think
they're more left-wing when you get outside of the United States, or is it because you don't think people don't really understand American politics?
Well, I think a little bit of both, actually. But I also think, for the most part, I think the Bush administration was pretty hawkish on a lot of even some of our allies and used a pretty heavy-handed tactic to kind of push its own policy agenda, which it got to do so a little more easily because of terrorism. But I think Obama's handling of, and even though it's got him a little bit of trouble with his respect for some of the Middle East, for example, where he, you know, revered, or not revered, but how he treated and looked at some of the Islamic leaders, those things are things I think that gave him a little more credibility and respect with some of the people and some of the countries that had not been very friendly toward recently.
So what's going on in Turkey? A lot of people, I don't think, understand that at all. A bunch of hippies decide to take over a park, and it turns into a riot, and the whole country's exploding. I mean, that's how it started, right? They went down and kind of occupied, took over this park, and didn't want them cutting down the trees because they were going to put something up there.
Yeah.
I mean, everywhere you look in countries like Turkey, everything's old.
Yeah.
So everything's an artifact. Yeah. So that's not new.
Yeah.
It explodes into this. How does that even happen?
Well, you know, I think it's always that. I think we talked about this before, where the pushback. Well, here's the thing. First of all, when you have a movement like this, it starts off with the one issue, which was the trees in Gezi Park, which is a very small park in Istanbul, and then it sort of propels itself into a because of the, you know, the riots start, and then it gets to be an issue with, you know, the President Erdogan's response to the protesters, and then they start to push back. And I think what happens when you think you have a democracy, and then you think you can go out and protest and sort of like raise hell, if you would, about the issue, and then all of a sudden when you find out, you get to find out just how free you are when you push back against the reins of power when you're challenging those in authority. I think Erdogan's push back against his population
of people, the citizens, has been very damning to him. I think it also reflects the deep divisions in Turkey, political, but the religious versus secular infrastructure in Turkey is a big problem here, huge problem with regard to this issue. And now it's almost not even about Gezi Park anymore.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And part of this is you have people who bandwagon. There are a certain portion of young people who just get on to want to hear themselves and, jump on the ship to go where everybody is for populist movement. The danger in this is that, you can ask these types of movements, but then the reality of, the next person, if you try and give it to Erdogan, who's been there long, he's been reelected multiple times, he's been in like a decade now, people are worried about him starting to solidify his base of power.
Yeah.
And then that becomes a whole issue of concern in and of itself, because they're afraid that he's never going to check out.
Yeah.
He'll be like Putin, right? He'll be from president to prime minister, back to president or whatever.
Yeah.
So you can't have that. And these people, again, you have a very semi-Eurocentric country combined with an Islamic country, and those clashes are going to rear their heads.
Because it seems like now if this guy comes out of power, you'll end up with some sort of Islamic fanatic in power as opposed to this guy, whereas his idea of freedom of religion is no religion, right? I mean, that's how they deal with it.
Yeah.
This is why, it's even, I think, illegal. I don't know how you make something like this illegal, but it's illegal for women to wear the
chador,
the burqa in public there.
Yeah.
So that's how they've dealt with religion. They just kind of ban it.
Yeah, like no ask, no tell, right?
Yeah.
Like, don't ask me about it. But then that comes back to haunt them. And the sad part about it, it's unfortunate we can't have an intelligent discussion about this issue without it being emotional.
Yeah.
But then maybe the very basis of religion is an emotion-based thing that you can't have a rational conversation around religion. It just seems to be, historically, you look at the the history of the world, and it's like it's every time you go down this road, it ends up.
How many Air Force bases do we still have an Air Force base in Turkey? We should, right?
Oh yeah.
We got a few, right?
Yeah, we got several bases in Turkey.
Yeah. So yeah. Turkey is very important for us.
Absolutely. And that's why to be honest with you, I don't think they could elect an Islamic leader, not a hardliner. I don't think they could get that done in Turkey. Too many Eurocentric secular young people. Too many people who are looking to the West, not to the South. I think it would be very difficult for them to get down that road.
Because they run right along the border with, Iraq?
Yeah.
Syria?
Syria, yeah.
They hit all of these key points for us.
So they have been politically our linchpin, and I think if it got to be a problem, we would provide some additional aid to them if they needed it.
But it depends on who we end up supporting, though, at the same time. That becomes the other problem.
Well, but I think...
Can we support this guy who's not going to get out of power as he should pass the reins on? Or, versus whoever the hell these kids are.
Well, the question becomes, who's the real Erdogan? Is he this guy who's trying to, looks like he's trying to solidify his own base? Or is he a person who has managed to somehow politically keep a certain level of balance in that hotbed system? And there are people, I know people who think he's great, and I know people who think he's not. It depends on where you stand is where you sit, and that becomes the issue.
Here's we got to a point where they start to harass the new Obama press relations guy about the red line, the famous Syrian red line.
Yet he himself did not address this issue that the red line had been crossed yesterday, and he's not here today. No disrespect to the three of you, but this is the president's red line. What would you say to those who might think that this is not such a big deal because the president's not giving voice to this theoretically significant event? And even your own inability to describe with any specificity the arms that would be going to the rebels, this sounds like an incremental policy change that the president, by not talking about it himself, is sort of keeping his arms length.
Well, Major, I think what I'd say to that is the situation in Syria is an ongoing challenge, and the president has repeated opportunities to speak to it. I'm certain he's going to have opportunities to speak to it, for instance, over the course of the several days that he'll be traveling to Europe. He himself is the one who laid out the red line publicly. But again, people have to understand that this is a very fluid and dynamic situation. Situation on the ground.
See, when they say stuff like that
its own,
to people,
twists and turns,
it makes Obama sound wishy-washy.
Yeah. Well,
here's a red line. And what the hell does that even mean, number one? And then the red line is crossed. Now what?
But wait a minute. Now, you know, let's be fair. It's a really wide red line. They didn't tell you how wide the red line was going to be. They just said it was a red line, right? They didn't say it was 1 foot.
I feel like I've heard this before.
but you know, but here's the thing.
Are there bot dots in this red line so that you know when you're
exactly? It's like the red line is amorphous, so you could move it around as much as you want, right? But here's the thing. I think it's really it's one of those things where
you can fully expect that the president will be.
I mean, this is what happens in policymaking. I mean, let's face it. If I would argue rightly so, to be honest, whether you're on the other side of the political aisle. Policy should be flexible. You know, should be flexible. If you try to create a policy, whether domestic or foreign policy, and try to put it in stone, and then you know, two things happen. One, it blows back on you like this, where the red lines cross and you don't know what to say about it. But more importantly, it doesn't give you any options. And I think you know things change in the international system so quickly. We have to be able to adjust for those changes. And if your policy is not flexible, you're not going to be able to do that. You're going to get caught looking backwards, and you're going to make a bad decision. And that's what happens when you have this kind of situation. So
I would not make that
policy making should always be flexible.
It's true.
And people don't like that because it looks like we're wishy-washy, but that's the very nature of policy making. It's a wishy-washy business. It just is. And that's never going to change.
But we've had opportunities over the course of the last several months to get better at establishing pipelines into the country. So we believe that our own efforts have improved in terms of streamlining the means by which we can work with some neighboring states to supply assistance into Syria. So I think we have essentially an established pipeline and established lines of communication and assistance that allow us to take additional types of assistance and put that into that pipeline.
What does additional type of assistance mean? Are we going to start sending them guns? I mean, Russia's sending them guns, right? China's sending them guns.
What are you talking about, Matt? I beg your pardon.
Are we going to start sending Syria guns? I mean, this is the new proxy war. It's almost 100,000 people. It's really sad.
Well, you know what's interesting about this to me, I mean, on a certain level, is the fact that just a couple weeks ago, you know, we had this whole issue about the red line, and that disappeared. And nobody talked about it for a few weeks. And now all of a sudden it's reared its head again about the red line thing. It's like
I think it's because of this assistance.
Well, yeah, of course. Well, yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's rearing its head again. But part of the reason it's rearing its head is because, you know, again, now that the game has changed, this is our response to the reality of what took place with Russia supplying additional weapons, you know, supplying weapons to for the Assad. Just like the whole idea with the chemical weapons.
Mm-hmm.
That came up a month ago. And then it disappeared. All of a sudden, it's back on the table again. The news yesterday. Aha. Now we can verify that they, you know, Assad used chemical weapons. Okay, so by saying that means you're now going to try and build a consensus around the fact that he is a dangerous guy. Now he's crossed the line that now we really have to, now we have verified information. Now we've got to be able to deal with him a different way. Well, you know, it's just kind of interesting how that, you know, it took him a month to figure out that he had actually used chemical weapons, and now they want to escalate the game. My question is, okay, so what changed that made you want to escalate that game? Well, the only thing that's changed is not the chemical weapons. It's the fact that in the last few weeks, Russia has been sending weapons, and it has really changed the nature of the outcome of that crisis.
Why does Russia want to get involved in this, in that conflict in this way?
Well, I mean, that's their one foothold in the region, really. I mean, Syria is their one foothold. They have that naval base, their small naval base there, and that's their only link to the area. And, you know, I think without that, it becomes a, you know, and also, you know, that's their one spot where they still have interest, that they can still be involved.
Where does Russia, what's sort of the next step if this thing escalates? What does that mean for Russia? I mean, can they escalate this in any way, or is this just one of those things where they can just keep throwing them AKs?
Well, I think it becomes still, I think they just throw them AKs. I don't think Russia can afford to escalate this in a way that, first of all, I don't think Russia wants to escalate it into a way where it's in, you know, a proxy war, you know.
That's what it feels like, though.
Well, I mean, it's not like, you know, like Vietnam or something like that. This is more, this is on a lower level, but it is the same essence, the same thing. You're playing a chess game using the people in Syria, which is the unfortunate part. The people in Syria are the ones that pay the price for this. But it's a price to become even more a proxy war, partially because Russia pushed up the ante. And the choice was either do you let Russia do this, knowing that you're going to solidify Assad's power in the region, or do you let it go by the wayside and just kind of or do you respond and try and help out those who are going to would probably lose their lives if this didn't happen? Because you know it's going to happen if Assad goes back. People don't think, we'll just use diplomacy and we'll all go back.
No, he'll kill everyone.
He'll kill everyone.
Yeah. Yeah. He will kill everyone.
Yeah, he will. Anybody who's a dissident, you better start leaving now, if that's the case. So that becomes the real problem. People don't want to deal with that, but it'll be a bloodletting. It would.
Yeah. Well, on that positive note.
Let's talk about quickly for a second. Let's talk about Iran.
Oh, the election in Iran. Yeah. I can't believe I left that out.
Yeah, just real quickly.
The election in Iran. That was kind of an interesting thing. A lot of people don't understand that. They have an election.
This is not a
parliamentary system, right?
Yeah, they have a parliament called the Majlis. Mm-hmm. And above the Majlis is the Council of the Guardian. Mm-hmm. And above the Council of the Guardian is the Ayatollah Khomeini.
Mm-hmm.
And, so basically they have a parliament that makes policies, and then it has to be sanctioned or approved by the Council of the Guardian and then the Ayatollah. So so you can make laws all you want, but they don't really mean anything until. But it's interesting that they even let this guy run, because a week ago they were talking about Rouhani. His name is Rouhani. And they were saying he's kind of more of a moderate. He's considered a moderate. In fact, the moderates are excited about the fact that he's the most. He's backed by Khatami, who was the former, before Ahmadinejad. He was the guy before who was a moderate.
I feel like I just learned how to say that guy's name, and he's out of office.
I know, huh? It took like 8 years to figure out how to say his name, and now he's gone, right? But it looks like he's, the people were cheering in the streets. People were dancing in the streets of Tehran, excited about the fact they've got somebody who looks like he's more West-leaning and at least progressively looking to the West. And
Iran hasn't made, they lost a lot of European business, really.
They lost a lot of business across the board because of the policies of the previous.
And they want to lift these sanctions.
Yeah, and this is a way for them to get down that road. And I think.
Do you think that green movement is going to have. It had an impact. Was it the green?
The green movement. Actually, I think it did, and I think that the younger people in Iran came out. I think it really showed very poignantly the changing demographic in Iran and how the old guard is kind of being pushed away. I mean, let's face it, the Ayatollah is in his 80s, and a lot of the Council of the Guardian are.
What happens when he dies?
Well, they'll have to get a new Ayatollah. But unless they, because the biggest problem in Iran right now is their constitution.
Yeah.
The Iranian constitution says that above the politics of the government of the is the religious institution.
Mm-hmm.
And if they modify or amend their constitution so that the constitution doesn't give the religious leaders power over the entire government, then you might be able to get some traction and change the dynamics of.
What's it take to change the constitution in Iran?
That's a good prayer. You need religion to get past it, right? No.
Yeah, the irony is.
Yeah, no, really. No, but it's interesting. I mean, there's a legal process, I'm sure. It probably would be a huge civil crisis to make it happen, because there are still those who are very staunchly, Islamist, and then you have those who are, who are very secular and want to have openness in that system. So, again, remember, Iran historically, prior to the theocracy, was a very powerful, secular nation in a lot of ways when the Shah was there. I'm not saying the Shah was a good guy, because he was not, in any way, shape, or form. But in terms of modernization within the country, certainly
this is what people are looking at. They're looking at Iran and Iran's history, and then they look at Turkey.
Yeah,
and where Turkey's at now.
Yeah,
Iran was a relatively secular, open country.
Yeah.
A lot of business with the United States, a lot of business with Europe.
But here's the big difference, though. The difference is between Iran and Turkey. The Shah, in the midst of a huge economic crisis in Iran, and the people were struggling financially, he's walking around with, opulence.
Yeah.
And that's what really got him in trouble. That plus his repression of any
People were literally starving.
Yeah.
They were actually starving in the streets in Iran.
In the mid-70s, in early to mid-70s in Iran, people were starving in the streets, and the Shah was running around with diamonds crusted crowns.
Yeah.
So, that didn't resonate well. It showed his
So who got out of Iran in the 70s and 80s?
All the plutocrats.
All the rich folks.
All the rich folks got out. All the rich folks left. They had to. In fairness, I had a lot of friends at UCLA back in the day who were from there, freshly off the boat, who were, because that they would say, couple of them whose families were very high in the leadership in Iran during the time of the Shah, who said we had to get out because our lives were in jeopardy.
Yeah.
So a lot of them got out and they saw the, you know, what was about to happen, and they got out quickly. But mm-hmm. in Turkey, it's different because, one, you have a huge, half the population is already European. You're a very Eurocentric background mm-hmm. In Turkey. Plus, you don't have a leader who's walking around like the Shah did. You know, he doesn't have that repressive organization, Sabak, like that the Shah had to repress and murder his dissidents, you know. But this is, so Turkey, is a much different situation, even mm-hmm. though I would say it does give you that semblance of secularism versus religion that is, again, always a problem in these types of countries.
Well, I'm working on that for a future podcast for us to get local religious leaders and talk to them about religion and politics.
Yeah.
So we're definitely working on that and a few other things we have in the bag.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so it's just, hopefully it's just going to get better. All right.
Another one down.
Another one down. Beautiful. Right here. I'm right with the fishing boats.
Yep. It's beautiful out here. Seriously. Now I'm going to go play Father's Day. And Matt, happy Father's Day to you, man. Yeah,
thank you.
This is your first one, right? This is your first
one? No, second.
Second one.
Yeah, we spent it at a carne asada, and then I just chased him around. Basically, is all we did, because he's at that age where he wants to grab and throw and
beat up on daddy, right?
Oh my god, this kid is so much work.
Yeah, welcome to fatherhood, my friend. Welcome to fatherhood. It only gets worse.
He's just a lot of work, but I like him.
Yeah,
and
that's a good thing.
I was worried. I know it sounds stupid, but I was worried that I wouldn't like him.
Yeah. Everybody, you know, everybody goes through that. You're gonna have a funny looking kid. Everybody worries about that too. The kid gonna be funny looking.
Is he a jerk?
Yeah.
I mean, all of those things. Yep. So far so good.
Yeah, he's a good looking little boy too. He is a good looking little boy.
Yeah, he's so far he's fun.
Yeah.
He even when he's being a pain in the ass, he's just trying to have fun. He's not trying to be mean. He honestly thinks he's having fun. Yeah. So.
Hey, Daddy, here. Look, I got a poopy diaper for you. Come on. Yeah.
See, he can't even say that yet.
I know,
if he could say that to me, I would be mad, because I know he's cognizant enough to shit in the toilet.
Exactly. but now he just looks at you and smiles and go, I know it's runny.
No.
you got to love it.
And on that note, on the poop jokes. Nothing like scatological humor
heck yeah.
Political podcast.
Heck yeah.
It fits in.
That's right.
It fits in.
The political bullshit, right?
It's all bullshit. Yeah. Bullshit and baby poop.
Happy Father's Day.